Hey, Mike.
Hey, Michelle. How's your week going?
Good. Fast. Busy. How about you?
Good, fat, and busy.
Fast.
Oh, fast.
Yeah.
Mine's good, skinny, and busy.
Well, skinny might be better than fat. That would work.
Usually not. I'd rather be fat than skinny.
Well, okay.
Michelle, what did you think of 308 Slip on Better Call Saul?
Okay. The first time I watched it, I was a little... I don't know why. I don't know if I was just bored. I don't know why, or not bored, but distracted. But I was a little bored with the beginning of the episode until the nacho stuff started, and then I was literally so anxiety filled and just so into that scene. My heart rate literally sped up, and I just thought it was one of the greatest episodes ever. And then the second time I watched it, I thought it was great all the way through. I picked up so much more with the second watching than I did the first. I think there are so many, I don't know if there's nuances or if I'm just dim. It could really be either way, seriously, because there was so much to see at the beginning of this episode that I just completely missed the first time.
You didn't like the correction of the unfairness of life? We all know that life isn't fair, but Jimmy corrected a couple unfairnesses that were pretty fun to watch, I think.
Yeah, I think it got better as that went on. The beginning of it where he's with Marco / Todd, Last Man on Earth Todd, all of that I just didn't really get at first. And then the second time I watched that, it was very, very meaningful for me.
Yeah, I like that justice. I like that karmic justice when it happens to, like, idiots who merge, who don't merge. They always cut in front of you in traffic. Like, it's the zipper effect, but they cut. They want to be the second or third car to get right in front of you. And then, you know, of course, this community service guy with all the false power and mini authority. I love seeing him get cut down to size.
Right. I don't know if I would call that karma, though, because it was more like revenge than karma. And karma, I like to see people get their comeuppance naturally. Revenge, maybe not quite so much. But I couldn't help but think that everybody who he did this to, who Jimmy did this to, definitely, in my opinion, deserved it.
I think it might stick with that guy a little bit, though, that community service guy. Like, he might be a little less of a asshat to the next people.
Maybe.
Or
maybe
he might double down. Who knows?
Yeah, I know. I know he may take all the frustration out on somebody else. You never know.
So I thought there was kind of a theme to that in this episode, like, it's all right to correct the wrongs by doing things the wrong way, which is kind of Jimmy's MO. It's how he works it as Saul, not the legal way, but the way that gets it done to meet his ends. And that's kind of what this episode's about. He gets past all the moral ambiguity of doing things the socially accepted legal way and gets them done hook or by crook.
Yeah. I saw it. I don't know. Maybe I'm reaching, but I really saw this internal struggle with him on this. Kind of like you're old enough to remember the Hulk, right? Lou Ferrigno, and how, you know, he would become the Hulk, but it was like this painful process when he did it. And I'm seeing Jimmy become Saul, but I don't think he likes it. And even if it's like a good thing to be able to do what he's doing, to right the wrongs, as you said, that doesn't mean that you want to be that person to do it. I feel like he struggled so long and so hard to not be Slippin' Jimmy, and now he is forced almost, or at least feels forced by circumstances, to be Slippin' Jimmy again. And I absolutely love, particularly after you sent me that picture of the Band-Aid box that Gene who is Saul, Jimmy, has in season one, episode one, and his personal belongings. That was so good. In this first scene, we saw every one of Saul's characters. We saw Jimmy. We saw Slippin' Jimmy. We saw Saul. And we even saw that piece of Gene that we've seen before.
Yeah, I like your analogy with the Incredible Hulk being a painful process, because the Jimmy really does hurt his back doing this. Trying to fake hurting his back, he really does hurt his back.
Right.
And then, it's funny because, you know, if you don't do this, then you're Jimmy's dad returning the precious coins that fall your way, or you're the Good Samaritan who gets buried in the desert. If you're just always the good guy and you're not looking out for opportunity or taking advantage a little bit of the things that happen in life. So I think there's no coincidence that these are kind of themes in this episode.
Well, I think it's a struggle. You know, it's a struggle between not letting people take advantage of you, but you not taking advantage of other people either. And where do you find the balance in that?
No, I don't think it's not taking... I mean, clearly saving the coin that's the silver dime or whatever, I don't think that's really taking advantage of somebody. That's just opportunity that shows up on your doorstep. Like, it's still worth 10 cents to the guy who spent it. And now if you find out later it's worth more, that's your opportunity. If you're the good guy, like the Good Samaritan, it's like the good guys always finish last, the theme almost. Like, he didn't do anything wrong. He did a lot right, and he paid for it with his life.
Yeah, but I see Jimmy struggling with this because he really feels like his parents were saps, I think. And I think he doesn't like that feeling. But... so we completely see, or I did, how little Jimmy, young Jimmy, turned into Slippin' Jimmy because he watched his parents being taken advantage of his whole life, which in turn made him take advantage of people. He felt like everybody was just out for themselves, I felt like.
So are you more like young Jimmy or older Jimmy? Or wait, are you more like young Jimmy or Chuck, where you would make sure that dime gets back to its rightful owner because it's really worth 13 cents and not 10 cents?
No, I think if I knew at the time that somebody would, it's just like if somebody is paying for something with they think they're giving you a dollar, but they give you $100 or whatever. I mean,
that's,
of course, I would hand
though.
It back.
That's a loss to them because they lose $99. A dime that's 10 cents either way, but you find out that, hey, it's made out of silver, and if I go to a little extra trouble, I could auction it, or I could sell it, or I could save it. That's different, I think, than somebody giving you the wrong bill.
Well, kind of, but is it? I mean, if somebody sells you a ring and they think it's a cubic zirconia and you buy it knowing it's a diamond, even though it's a cubic zirconia, they think.
What if they're happy with the price that you pay them for it?
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't feel okay about
the guy,
that.
The guy who gives you the 100 is going to find out later on when he looks in his wallet, where's my 100? I must have given that out thinking it was a 1. That's a big difference to me.
Yeah, but and I completely understand that, but it's not about them. It's about me. And it's about, you know, how I wouldn't want to take advantage even if they didn't know I was taking advantage. If I knew at the time that it happened, I would certainly let them know. I would.
So the road crisscrossed a couple times, too, between Chuck and Jimmy, and their real pain and their fake pain. Like, Jimmy's faking an injury and gets a real injury, and Chuck has no injury but thinks he has an injury. That was kind of interesting, too. Chuck's almost admitting that he has this problem now.
Yeah, which was great. And that's a great point. I did not think of that, of the real pain versus the fake pain and what brings which on. That's a good point.
So the Band-Aid box coincidence is it was on the Better Call Saul podcast. It's no measure of detective work or anything. They said it. Hey, that box, was that in there before? Yeah, that was the Band-Aid box from the Gene episode. So that was just easy to catch. But it's the Gene has a box in the very first season one, episode one, where he goes into a shoebox in his secret hiding place and he pulls out a VHS tape of the Saul Goodman commercials. And while he's rummaging around for that VHS tape, there's a Band-Aid box in there. And that's the Band-Aid box that was in the roof ceiling tile of Jimmy's dad's store where the coins were kept. So, and then on another interview somewhere, Bob Odenkirk said the contents of this floor shoebox in Gene's apartment are going to be important.
Okay.
So the only other thing in there, what else was in there? I don't know. Maybe there's still something in the Band-Aid box that we don't know about.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, we saw him dump it out. Remember, he just went back to it.
So the other interesting thing to me in this one, Michelle, was the Howard problem. I used to think I liked Howard. I hated Howard, liked him. Now I kind of hate him again because it looks like he hates both Chuck and Kim. I thought he was kind of protective, kind of secretly protecting Kim.
Yeah, I was going to ask you what you actually thought about that after this episode, because I've never trusted Chuck as much as you have. And I was going to see if Howard. And I was going to see if this episode changed your mind.
I think he's just trying to keep his firm together at any cost. And he's kind of faking it with Chuck.
But oh, now, come on. He's a douche, though. Going over to her while she's having that meal, the brunch, whatever they're having. Oh, he's a douche
for sure. That's what I'm saying. I'm thinking I was wrong about that. But he's faking it with Chuck. Chuck, oh, you're my man. We'll do whatever we can to get Jimmy out of here. Now Chuck's a huge liability. And when he can't fake it with the public anymore about Chuck, then he wants to get rid of Chuck. And, you know, obviously there's something coming up that he's intimating about this malpractice that he's got to deal with.
Yeah, but remember, we found out a while ago, they wanted to get Chuck out. I think it was season one.
Yeah, the very beginning.
Jimmy, yeah, but they would have had to buy him out, and they could not afford to do that. Would bankrupt the company. So they're kind of stuck with Chuck, I think.
Well, now there may be a way to get him out, now that he's kind of proven that he's quasi-insane.
Right.
All right, Michelle, you want to jump into it?
Let's go.
So it kind of starts out with Jimmy and Marco in the old Jimmy's dad's store. I think it's in Joliet or Cicero. I can't remember which town. Chicago area town.
Yeah.
And it's a dark office. They kind of break in, right?
Yeah, they do break in. Uh-huh.
They show, Jimmy shows Marco where his mom used to. It was cool seeing Marco, too, by the way.
It really was, yeah. And Marco seems to have really nice memories of this place, of this store, and of Jimmy's mom giving him Little Debbies and stuff. And Jimmy's got the opposite memories.
I think Marco's a happy guy, just like kind of a happy idiot, kind of happy with everything, happy with his little scams. All he wants to do is make enough money to drink some beer, hang out at the bar. You know, he seems pretty easy to please.
I was talking about people like that with my daughter today. We were out together, and how some people, they just kind of float through life and they don't worry about much. And, you know, and we're such type A people that we plan everything out and, you know, all that kind of stuff. We care if we're late to something I guess more specifically care about being on time and all that kind of stuff. And, how much easier it would be if you were that kind of person.
And sometimes it's really attractive to people. Like, that really got January Jones interested in him. In The Last Man on Earth. He was just simple. Simple and yes. Easy and fun.
Well, and that one of two men. Not that's
a show, but...
On Earth, but yeah.
And he was the last man. But they look up in the ceiling tiles and get that coin collection out of the Band-Aid box. They find the Band-Aid box and... Jimmy tells the story. People used to pay with valuable silver coins, and Jimmy would stash them away. And I still say I don't think Jimmy was bad for this. He was just kind of surviving, even though he maybe was selfish. He was keeping that for himself. But his dad would have given it all away, given it all back. Jimmy said that he had deadbeats that owed him money, that he worked his heart out for years for nothing. He probably gave credit to people that didn't pay him back. But Jimmy, you know, Jimmy stretches that. He says, too. I would have sold beer and cigarettes to the kid at Mary Margaret's, too.
It's It's completely different to me, just to get back on that for 1 second, if Jimmy goes in and goes through the till later and finds coins that people have given, because he would have had no way to have known who they came from or what at that point. So him doing that and putting them in that Band-Aid box and putting it up is one thing, but him receiving something from somebody and knowing it while they're standing there, that, I don't know, that's akin to like people, like if you wanted to go to a bank and get a roll of pennies, so maybe you could get the, you know, wheat pennies or whatever they're called out, right? I mean, you know, that's different than if you know you're getting something, to me. But yeah.
Well, didn't Jimmy say that's what he did? He went through the till after the day was out and found all the valuable extra special coins?
That's what he said he did. He said every day after school, I think, that he would go through the till. And he did that because that one coin, that silver coin that he showed his father that was worth more money, his father ran outside trying to give it back. And then when he couldn't give it back to the guy had left, he taped it to the side of the register and waited. And then when evidently the guy didn't come back in or whatever, he was going to donate it. And, all I mean, right, you know, well, they were hurting for money because they lost the convenience store.
Yeah, every dollar that Jimmy's dad didn't, every minute he didn't spend making his business more productive, he didn't contribute to his family. So while he was running around returning money and being special about not making sure everybody got exactly, you know, he was essentially not running that business as well as he could have. We're going to end up looking at this differently, but that's how I look at it, that, you know, why worry about that stuff? Worry about making your business more successful and forget, you know, so what? Some guy gives you a dime that's worth a silver dime that's worth 25 cents. It's water under the bridge.
Well, I don't think that's it so much anyway in this. I think that it's a point in this, but I think the bigger issue was Jimmy talking about how everybody with a sad story would come in and leave with a pat on the back and a gallon of milk. And Mike and I had a conversation as we watched this together tonight. I said, you know, but how do you know somebody needs a gallon of milk for their family and not give it to them? And he said, well, because that's not business. You know, yeah, he said,
I would agree with that. I wouldn't give milk. That's $1.90, whatever the gallon of milk cost in 1982, right, that your family loses and your family's hungry. That is bad. That is not good of his father to do that. His father's not a good, it doesn't make him honorable to me to do that.
I don't disagree. I don't disagree with you. I'm just saying that I sympathized with the dilemma that he was in.
Well, take a stand. Are you giving the hungry family the gallon of milk, Michelle, as the clerk, or are you not? You're telling them to go on their way.
Well, it's like Mike said. Mike said, as soon as you do that with one person, it turns into everybody because everybody knows you're the person who gives the milk.
So you're not answering. What does Michelle do?
If I knew the people and I knew that they needed the milk, they have these children. I mean, I don't think people need milk, but you know, whatever it might be, if it were friends or people who came in all the time or just down their luck, maybe, but to everybody or to people I didn't know, no, I could not do that as a business person. I would not do that.
Okay. All right. So that takes us right to the credits and we come back to the Oasis Motor Court sign.
Hey, let me ask you one question. I'm sorry. Sure. Before we go on from that, why was he in there getting that money? Were they going to go do that scam that they did before?
There was some convention in town,
right,
that they were going to go to. Yeah, they were going to scam. You know, Jimmy's not a saint. Like, oh, now I'm going to take my silver dime and get. You know, they were going to fake it out and fool people and cheat people with it. I get that. Totally.
Okay.
Yeah, there was a convention in town. Remember, they talked about, oh, we can get 45 for, no, 45. We're getting 300 for this.
Right.
They
okay.
They were going to scam people with the fake jewelry.
Okay.
Fake coins.
I just wasn't sure if he were just needing the money, and so he was getting these, you know, like scraping the bottom of the barrel, essentially, on getting these coins to get more money.
Well, they are. It is well, scraping to break back in and get a 10-year-old Band-Aid container.
Yeah,
but they are doing it for money.
Yeah, okay.
You know, they're probably going to go out and have a night on the town with that $300. All right, so Oasis Motor Court sign. By the way, I think this Oasis is the place where Walt goes and when he has to rush out and rob Jesse of the meth to get in time to meet Gus's deal. And he goes to the Oasis Motor Court. That's an abandoned Oasis Hotel, Motor Court Hotel. I think that's really? What that's for.
Oh, wow. But this, love that.
This sign is, I think we've seen Mike hide behind here too with his spike strip that he pulls out or whatever. He hides his car behind it before.
Yeah, I think I do remember that there.
But I think that's where Walt did the first Gus deal. So Mike's in his black cap and metal detector and portable shovel. And he's looking around for something we don't quite know yet. Did you guess what it was going to be, Michelle?
No, and I wouldn't have guessed that he would have done it that way either. What notes was he checking? Do you remember? Did he do like longitude and latitude or something? Because he flipped open that little notebook and he's got like these little handwritten notes in there.
No, I think that's from when he had the conversation with Nacho. Remember the 1 point, 2 or 3 episodes ago? He's like, I need you to tell me something.
Oh.
And that was what I think we talked about this maybe in the podcast too. It's like, what he wanted was, where did you bastards bury that Good Samaritan?
Oh,
so he probably
okay.
wrote down the notes from what Nacho told him.
Okay. Wow. Okay, good. Good catch. I had no idea what that was even from.
We never heard that, but I think that's what probably it is.
That makes sense, yeah.
So, you know, it's kind of a little more mysterious. Like, how do you know that a body's going to have metal that would be detectable? But you'd probably figure, you know, a belt buckle or a ring or, you know, something.
Okay. Is this Anita's husband? Have we figured that out yet?
No, I think it's the Good Samaritan.
And that's not going to be the same person, you
don't
think?
No, because Anita's husband left.
Was long ago.
8 years prior to the Good Samaritan.
Okay.
Good Samaritan only happened a month ago.
Okay, so... But the Good Samaritan story and Mike seeing Anita so torn up over this is what makes him want this not to happen to, like, some other woman somewhere.
Well,
is that
probably.
What we're going to assume? Okay.
Yeah, probably. It's like a memory refresher.
Okay.
Also, we see later in this episode that Gus has the problem where he needs to launder the money that he got from this truck heist when he cut open the tire and took the money. That's the money he's trying to launder with Gus.
Right, right. Mike needs to launder. Yeah, okay, yeah.
Yeah, so he's looking around in the desert. It looks like for hours they do kind of a time lapse of Mike being in different spots, different positions, as he does a grid pattern around that stake to find the money. And this kind of reminded me, Michelle, too, of another thing that's a kind of a theme in the show, a mini theme maybe, but digging. Digging's always been important in the show.
Hmm.
Several important points of plot were digging. Tucker's hole. Remember Tucker? Tucker! When Mike and Jesse were... Jesse first was getting kind of wooed by Mike. They went to find who was taking the meth. And it was those two guys high on meth. And Jesse kind of got the guy's attention by digging a hole.
Yeah, you're right.
Tucker's hole. There was Walt's money stash at Tahajali where he buried the 6 barrels or 8 barrels, whatever. And then, of course, Gomez and Hank in that same hole. There was the train heist reservoir where they dug a hole for the tank for the meth in the water.
Wow, this is a lot, yeah.
And then now it's the Good Samaritan. So he finds some sort of a body, I'm guessing it's the Good Samaritan. I'd say 95%, I think that's who it is.
Yeah, I agree.
And it's apparently on tribal property. I think that's news, too.
Right.
Mike calls it into the tribal police.
Mm-hmm.
Anonymously. All right, next scene, Chuck and his doctor. Chuck has records of his pain history, and he's kind of telling her all about that. Although it's interesting, he's doing this in his dark, without lights on setting. He can't even manage to endure the light while he's trying to recover from this fake illness he has.
And what kind of credit's he giving her? I mean, he's giving her credit for how far he's come. And it's like you said, I'm not seeing anything yet about how far he's come. And he's it's like you said earlier, he's pretty much admitting that he realizes this is probably not a physical illness, but a psychological illness, which I thought was huge to hear him say that. And then, of course, we see him, you know, push through some stuff a little bit later. But what has she done? How did she push him forward?
I don't know. I don't think they go into that too much. She gives him a little working therapy for it, like to notice colors instead of just noticing pain.
Right.
That kind of seems like it works a little bit. I mean, this almost makes Chuck turn a little bit away from being such a diabolical fuckhead that you almost start to say, well, maybe I feel a little sorry for the guy. That worked for a second for me, but it didn't really last too long because I still don't like him. But I don't know. She kind of keeps him on the straight and narrow. He's apparently been out of the law, out of the courtroom and the law work for 3 years. We find that out.
Right.
And he wants to jump right back into real life and work and have parties and friends come over. And, you know, she slows his roll a little bit and tells him, like, let's be realistic about this. So, and I don't know, maybe she's just helping him become more realistic.
Yeah, and I kind of agree with you. I don't like him anymore, and I'm not going to probably. But his end statement where he says, what if it's all in my head, and if it's not real, then what have I done? Even though I dislike him, I would like to see him come out of this. I doubt that's what we're going to see. I hope we do, but I doubt we will. But
yeah, that's a somewhat profound. What have I done if my condition is not real? Like, what did I just do to my brother? Almost.
Right.
Or what, right. What have I done to the Hamlin McGill law firm?
Right. And to his life. I mean, he's literally imprisoned himself for 3 years, imprisoned himself without conveniences or anything, you know, modern comforts of any kind, hardly. And it's just to come to a realization like that would just be devastating.
So I guess this connection with the doctor being brought back to life was the result of his payphone journey that night, where he went out in, among all the lights, and went to the payphone.
Right.
And that was due to the hearing incident where he was exposed for all his fakery. So maybe he had a little bit of a light come on for him. You know, he saw something that he didn't see before.
Do you think Jimmy's going to give some comeuppance to Chuck? I mean, I know he already has in a way, but like, do you think it's possible, just as a guess, that Chuck is going to come around and turn into a good guy and be, I'm so sorry that I've done this to you, and Jimmy's going to, you know, saul him or whatever?
I guess it's possible, but I'll tell you, I hope they don't do that, because I'm just tired of Chuck. Even if he comes full circle and he's all of a sudden the glowing angel and helps Jimmy, because we see what happens to Jimmy. You know, he might give him some temporary reprieve.
Right.
But maybe he gets his year shortened to 6 months. But I don't really care about Chuck anymore. So I hope they don't try to build that story up.
Well, we know that we don't see him in the Saul years. I mean, I guess we don't know, but we didn't see
him.
Well, we don't know how
long this show's going to go. He may.
Well, that's true.
I mean, I think we've already seen him too long.
Okay. What year did Breaking Bad start? What year did we see Saul?
We saw Breaking Bad start, I think, in 2008. And I think Saul was in the second season, so.
Okay, so it was 2009 before we, like, even in their time.
Yeah, they don't have, I think Vince Gilligan's even kind of admitted this, that he doesn't correlate show time to real time.
Okay.
So you can't say, in 2009, there was the time when.
Okay. Because they did show the exact date in this episode on Kim's check.
Okay.
So it was March 4th, 2003. So that just made me really wonder how, you know, how far away we are from Walt and Jesse.
Yeah. Well, 5 years, I guess a lot could happen.
Yeah, a lot.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know what that's going to help us figure out. But
I don't either.
Jimmy goes to the music store and finds out his ad is really working now. They've had way more people than they've had for the last few weeks or weekends. And these two guys, these Sklar brothers, I don't even know their names in the show. Did you catch what their names are?
No, I don't remember.
It doesn't matter. I don't like these guys either. They're just weasels. They find out that he's not really working for the station, and they did a little math, and they figured out, or they did a little checking, that you're 7 commercials for $6,500. We can just go to the station for $450.
Right, which would still be almost half of what Jimmy was asking, Saul Productions was asking, and they were producing and doing the commercials. So it's not a terrible deal that he's doing. And his commercials have brought business. So I didn't like the way they treated him at all.
It's a terrible deal for them. And it's a screwing of Jimmy. That's both things. Because you don't need 7 new commercials. You could run that one commercial for 3 months. You don't need a new commercial every week. So Jimmy's trying to unload these commercials at a coin in their accelerated price structure. And they find out about it. So the thing that's bad is they don't do what they agreed to do, which is, hey, if this works, we'll do that deal with you. They find out it works, and now they still want to chisel them even more.
That's exactly what I said. That's exactly what I wrote down, was the thing that really bothers me with the whole thing is that they agreed to do it and took his... took the commercial free the first time based on if he gets more business, they will take that deal. And then they backed out of that.
They even doubled down on that. They claim they can replicate his whole operation and just do it themselves. All you got is UM students doing this. I can go find University of New Mexico students.
Right.
So, Michelle, I like how they're using the real life economics of people cheating the system, that Jimmy is frustrated by it. And it might, you know, this might be part of what turns him into Saul. He's almost like, screw this, man. You may be technically right, but I don't like this, and I don't want to go along with it. And, you know, this is a step towards his Saul-ness.
Yeah, well, see, I think it even goes beyond that. I think he feels like he's down, and he is being repeatedly kicked while he's down. That's how I feel about him. You know, he tries to get the money back for the commercials that he cannot air because, you know, he was suspended. And they won't give him the money back. So he does, you know, what he can to try to make, you know, some money back on that. And now he's getting, you know, kind of screwed over by the people that agreed to do that. And he is bringing them in business. So, but there's that. There's... every situation, the insurance, everything he tries to fix, the community service guy, everybody's just kicking him while he's down. And, you know, if he were an attorney standing up for these people, we would love him. But the fact that he's standing up for himself kind of makes you a little uncomfortable, makes me a little uncomfortable with some of his, you know, decisions.
He really just ends up doing what they're doing to him back at them, and, you know, can't beat them, join them. So he says, okay, you're gonna try to screw me, then I'll just play by the same non-rules that you're playing by.
That's what he does.
Maybe a little bit more lax of rules than them, but he doesn't give up. He does a slip and fall in the music store, trips over a drumstick, really kind of hurts himself.
That he placed there, though.
Yeah, he set it all up. Keep that camera aimed right over here.
Yeah, so we totally... met Saul last week, and we met Slippin' Jimmy. Really met him this week.
Yeah, that's good. All right, Michelle, we go to the potted plant drink scene here. Kim and Paige, we saw these drinks, and they looked like potted plants. That was funny. But Kim and Paige and Kevin are having drinks that look like Moscow mules served in copper mugs that look like they don't look like drinks when you see it still. But they're talking about a four-corner strategy for the four-corner states of Kevin's bank expansion.
Yep.
Kevin has a tea time, so he wants to get this done and get the heck out of there. And Kim admits that she's a golfer, Michelle. So
she does.
There's more bondage between Kim and Kevin. And Kevin really likes Kim. He's about to give her more business with an oil drilling company. And Paige tries to slow the roll on that a little bit. She's tried this a few times. She's almost like the safety buffer for Kevin.
Yeah, I've noticed that. She is the one. Kevin kind of takes everything, particularly with Kim, I think at this point at face value. And it's like Paige is the one who double checks everything and makes sure everything is as it's supposed to be. Because she even points out that Kim's pretty busy with what she's doing alone with them.
And yeah, what's Paige's role with the Mesa Verde?
I'm not sure. I thought she was an attorney. But
so she might be an attorney, just not a specialized attorney like Kim.
Yeah, I thought this whole time that she was like an in-house attorney.
She might be. But that's how she knows Kim. It's interesting, though, that she lets Kim in and then she protects the company from Kim being too close. It's a weird role. It's an interesting role to see.
I completely agree. It almost feels like she's protective over Mesa Verde, we see, but it almost feels like she's a little, I don't want to say jealous. She's not jealous of Kim, but she's just cautious, I guess, more cautious.
She'd be a great employee to have because she gets a great asset in finding Kim, but then she doesn't just let Kevin go whole hog head over heels for her. She kind of slows it to a moderate role. I think that's smart.
She definitely keeps him, or keeps Kim, honest, I would say.
All right, so Howard rolls into the Moscow Mule restaurant and rolls right up to the... I guess he's just in for another reason. He's not following Kim or anything, but he just rolls in, sees her there, walks right up to the table. Hey, you're really lucky to have her. Kind of gives the left-handed compliment, doesn't let Kim stand up to greet him, does a total power move on the whole table, and kind of minimizes her experiences with a little bit of left-handed complimentary here.
Oh, it's awful. Calls her a protege. I mean, it's awful. Talks about her, you know, well, I don't think he does right here, but working in the mail room. And I mean, it's just you can tell what he thinks about Kim, and it turns out that he's mad. And I mean, he's mad at her because of what happened in that law hearing, and it's ridiculous. It is absolutely ridiculous.
I can see why he's mad at her because he's essentially had his company ruined by it.
But that's not her fault.
Oh well. You know. She was pretty instrumental in bringing the secret to light that he didn't want to. I mean, it's not a lie, but she was the reason he has all these problems now.
Okay, so because his company tried to destroy her company, because Jimmy's half of her company, as much as Chuck is a third of their company. So because his company tried to destroy her company, and she stood up for her company, pointing out that the inconsistencies and the problems with that company, and she pointed them out, which she had to. She was forced to. Her hand was completely forced. Then somehow he has a right to be mad at her?
Yeah, he doesn't have a right to be, but it's understandable why he is mad.
No,
he's not
going to
shake hands with her and say, oh, good fight in the courtroom. You're the winner. I congratulate you on your victory. He's mad about it. It's wrecking his...
No, you don't get to start a fight and then be pissed off when somebody whips your ass. You don't get to do that. Not in my book.
You don't know why he's mad, though? You don't understand why he's angry?
I understand why he feels defeated, of course, by that. But for him to take it, I mean, sometimes you have to look at yourself, right? And he is not doing that. He has to look at the fact that this is his fault. Not her fault. She didn't have a choice. It's not like she found out about Chuck and just set out to ruin him. Chuck had set out to ruin her company, and she defended her company. And now he's mad at her about that. And it's just like one of the most ludicrous things I can possibly imagine. Of course she's going to defend her company.
Michelle, are you still mad at Grant and Sherman for what they did in 1865?
No, I've let it go.
You're a Yankee now?
No, I'm not a Yankee.
I don't begrudge people that get defeated for being mad at the people that beat them, even if the people that beat them do it fairly, squarely, and deserve to win. I can understand why the one that's vanquished is mad.
And if we're talking about like a sport or something, then I can understand being, you know, frustrated. It's not that different.
If somebody wins a big contract from you and you walk up and you see them in a restaurant, you can be, you know, he's civil, but he's not thrilled with her. He's not happy.
He's not civil. He came up to deliberately mock her.
He came up because they saw him. He can't ignore them. They're in a social place. He's got to come up and say hello.
No, he interrupted. They were in the middle of a conversation. They hadn't seen him, and they might would have seen him. He could have come up and said hello, but it's just like you said, completely backhanded compliment.
Well, he does all that, but he's two tables away in a restaurant, and Kevin and Paige know him. He's not going to sit down and not come over and say hello.
No, you can come over and say hello, but you don't have to come over and say hello and then talk about how, oh, I'm so glad this is working out with her, you know, the girl who used to get our coffee. I mean, come on.
He's very spiteful, but I see why he's mad. All right, so Kim excuses herself and goes kind of private and writes a check for $14,815.
Yep.
And then pulls the reverse control move on him and says, you sit, little doggy.
I was so glad she did that. Yeah.
So they leave, and Kim has looks like a new client and a new golf buddy, and she's negotiated her way through this pretty well, I think.
Yes, she did.
So Howard catches up with her, questions the check, and now he's doing damage control because of all the stuff that happened to his law firm after she and Jimmy, he says it this way, but she and Jimmy dragged it through the mud. And tears up the check, and Kim says, kind of what you're saying. All we did was show your situation for what it really is. You were hiding it, and now it's not hidden anymore.
Well, yeah. He says, we took you out of the mailroom, put you through law school, and this is how you repay me? I mean, really? I couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe he said that. I was watching it with Mike, and Mike said a very dirty word to him when he said that to her. And I absolutely felt it, you know, and I just thought that it was kind of like, you know, how Chuck is with Jimmy. He's trying to he did her, Howard just did, the same way Chuck has treated Jimmy. You know, I got you into the law firm and I did this, and then this is how you repay me. And Howard just did, he just said that out loud to Kimmy. Yeah.
But the value to Kim of getting started in this law firm is a lot less than the damage to Howard of what Chuck being exposed as hurt the law firm.
I know, but it's like somebody throwing it's like somebody shooting you. And the bullet ricochet, you're able to put up a shield, and the bullet ricochets off you and hits them, and then they're mad at you about it. That's exactly what happened here. And I'm very, very defensive for her. But she does, she tells him, she says, if he hid Chuck's illness from his clients, then that's on him. You know, because he tears up the check, and he says he's not going to take her check. Her debt's forgiven, and everything else is on you. And she says, well, if you hid Chuck's illness from the clients, then that's on you.
So what and do you she think, drives away. What do you think the setup, what do you think the show universe setup of this is? Even though you and I aren't necessarily agreeing, why are they having Howard do this, and why are they having Kim push back when both Howard and Kim have nothing at all to do with Breaking Bad and seemingly very little to do with Saul?
Well, see, I think we also have to remember that Kim feels bad. And I'm frustrated at her and with her for feeling bad over standing up for her own company and for Jimmy. But she does. And she didn't want to do that. So the only thing I can think is that Howard is going to be this force, you know, in getting rid of Chuck, or trying to, and it's just going to, like, be the straw that breaks the camel's back with Kim. But, I mean, that's just a guess.
So what you're saying is you're now a Hector fan.
I am not just saying I'm a Hector fan.
All right, well, no. We get to see Nacho make some capsules now at his father's shop. He has a big old, what do you call that thing, pestle? What's the masher and what's the bowl?
Yeah, a mortal, oh my gosh, I can't believe I can't think of it.
A mortar and pestle.
And pestle, yeah.
So what's what, though? Is the grinder, is the thing you hold in your hand the pestle or the mortar?
Mike, I can't believe I don't know the answer to that, but I don't know.
Well, the bowl looked big and had a lot of powder in it, so you could have made a lot of capsules out of that.
Right.
He's not just making one, I think, is the point. He's making enough so that he has as many as Hector has in his pill container when he finds it.
Well, yeah, he didn't know.
So just like Mike takes a long time to painstakingly go through that desert grid, Nacho takes a long time to painstakingly make these capsules.
Well, yeah, and I love that little spoon. He literally used like a, I don't know where you might get one of those, a little, you know, like a medication spoon.
It's a spudger. They call them a spudger.
Is that really what it's called?
You know what they use them for? Is they use them for like taking a circuit board off of a computer motherboard.
Really?
Yeah, it's a little flat edged, not sharp, but a kind of a flat edged. It's like what it is like, what do they call those knives for like dip and cheese and dip and stuff that's short and just a little spudger. It's not like a real knife. It's not like a scalpel.
Okay, that's pretty cool.
Not a screwdriver, but.
The mortar is the bowl. The pestle is the heavy, blunt, club-shaped object.
Okay, now I can sleep tonight.
Now I know. Now we know.
So Nacho makes these capsules and then practices the switch.
You saw what he put in them, right?
Cyanide?
No, it was ibuprofen. He was crushing up Advil.
Oh, so it's a placebo.
Placebo for his nitroglycerin.
I think he calls it nitroglycerin.
That's so bad.
You think it's going to help you, but it's nitroglycerin.
Oh, my goodness. Okay.
And then he practices not only the switch of tossing the bottle, but holding the bottle. Very detailed, intimate characterization of what he's worried about here when he goes through this process.
Well, and he can't ever get it. Did you notice?
Well, not in the practice run, he can't get it. I bet we don't see the whole time that he practices, though.
I got to tell you. When this was years and years ago, it's just this little thing that this reminded me of. But I was on a pom-pom squad, and we danced, and we had this move that we were doing. And it was really this crazy thing. We were passing the pom-poms, and and it was a great move, and we never could get it. And we rehearsed it, and we rehearsed it, and we rehearsed it. And it got down literally, it was like 5 minutes before we were performing. And we could not get this move. Somebody would mess it up because it required, there were 16 of us, a bunch of us, and it required everybody to be exactly perfect, exactly on time for this whole long move. And we got right down to it, and it was like, let's just change it. Let's just do something else. We can do something else. We can simplify this. And somebody's like, no, let's don't. Let's go out there and let's do it. And we got out on the floor, and we did it. And it went perfect. So anyway, it just reminded me of them.
Yeah, I don't think Nacho does that though. I think he practices like all night.
Probably.
His dad shows up in the morning and he's still there.
Right. But I was just saying it really reminded me, and I know this has a whole lot more, you know, potential devastating facts, but it really reminded me of that, because everything they showed him doing that they showed us was so bad and not even close to being good. And anyway.
Yeah, anyway, he never gets it in practice. It always hits the side of the coat. He even gets a jacket somewhere. I don't think he owns one, but he just gets it just to practice it.
Right.
Goes to a lot of degrees. It's a pretty monumental measurement of how afraid he is of Hector.
Absolutely. And I thought it was so cool also that they showed his dad walking in, because that showed what he's doing this for.
Yeah, really he personalized it.
Yeah, he does not have a choice. And not only that, but his dad was like, oh, you're here early. Oh, that's so great. I love you taking an interest in the business. And it was like, you know, it was really good to see that and be reminded of that, because otherwise you kind of tend to think, okay, he's out to hurt this man, and it feels kind of sinister. And I mean, it is sinister anyway, but you see at least why he's doing it. So I thought that was pretty cool.
Well, yeah, that man who comes in, his father, is a dead man if he's not successful at doing this whole plot.
Right, right, through absolutely no fault of his.
All right, well, we go to see next Chuck going to the store, and he's noticing all the colors, going through the little routine that his therapist gave him. He suffers his way through everything, all the lights, and runs the gauntlet of the refrigerated aisle. Why do you think they showed this scene, Michelle? Why are we worried about frickin' Chuck? This is telling me that they're going to keep him around.
Yeah, I don't know, but I got to tell you, I mean, you know, it's just like you were talking about earlier. I mean, I was pulling for him. I mean, I'm so happy that he's in the store. I'm so happy that he's able to do this. I think in true Breaking Bad style that they're going to pull Chuck back from the edge where we hated him so much, and then they're going to kill him. That's what I think. Just to, you know, gouge us a little bit.
Maybe they did a contract with Michael McKean, and it was like 3 years, and they got to get all 3 years out of it from him.
That would be funny.
I don't know, though. I just don't know what plot-wise he could help with in the future. All right, Kim's looking at the Gatewood Oil case now, Gatewood Oil case. She's got a big box of their documents. Those documents need to be back at Gatewood by some delivery by the end of day, and she tells Francesca about it. And Jimmy is laying on his back. This is another scene we discussed, Michelle. We didn't know what he was doing, but he's laying on his back playing his new Ritchie Blackmore guitar.
Yes, he is.
In his office at the office he has with Kim. And he's got some dough now. He's got a new guitar and some money because he said he sold all of his ads. Plus, he got a guitar out of it.
Yeah.
And Kim starts to quiz him about his injury, and he pays her 6 weeks' worth of bills. So Kim doesn't quite know what's wrong, but she looks very suspicious of what's going on here. And she says, you should rest. Don't push yourself like this. I don't think that totally means that she thinks he's working his butt off and hurting his back. And I think she's suspicious of something.
I think you could be right, but now you've said before that you don't like how she is with him. And I've, as far as the money goes, and I've kind of given her the benefit of the doubt. But in this, he tells her that he's got something on his desk, and it's the money. It's the 6 weeks' worth of money. And he cuts her off. He's really short with her about it.
And, yeah, because now she does offer to pay the expenses for a while.
But he must have felt it, too, what you felt. Or he wouldn't be so, I wouldn't think, so short with her over the money. He's like, just take it.
Plus now she's kind of guilty, like, oh, this guy's slaving away so much that he's working all day as the community service, hurt his back, and he's going out and trying to make money. He's hustling left and right. And now he's, like, injured from it. So I don't know. Maybe she does believe it, that he's just working super hard to get money for her. But I don't know. It looks suspicious.
Yeah, I don't know though. I mean, I'm not big on that. I'm not big on let's wait until somebody is in dire straits to be kind to them in a situation like that. It's just like you said before. You know, she's making plenty of money, and why is she, taken? Half of everything, knowing that he can't even have an attorney income. So yeah. I'm kind of leaning in your direction.
Well, I think she's offering it now because he's physically hurt himself. Like, you got to slow down.
I think she's offering it now because she's afraid of what he is doing, is what I think.
He's pressing the illegal button, you mean?
Maybe, yeah, because she knows he's capable.
Maybe. But what clue does she have that he's doing that?
I don't know. I don't know. But why else would she be offering it now? And the only clue I've got is that she starts to walk out and he asks, hey, you believe me, don't you? What was he saying? You believe right. What?
he pulls an Emmett Stussy here, and you believe me, right? I'm not doing anything illegal.
Right.
He kind of tips her off to like, oh, maybe there is something that he's trying to convince me of.
Exactly.
And she says yes, but does she? Does she really believe him? She seems too smart to just carte blanche buy it.
Yeah, I think if she believes him, it's just because she wants to believe him.
So she cancels the Gatewood document returns. This is her, I think, thinking, I can make a lot of money with Gatewood myself instead of referring it to somebody else.
Right.
And maybe I can help Jimmy by this extra money being contribution to the monthly bill. But, you know, I don't see how she can have that much trouble paying her monthly bills with the Mesa Verde. She's not going to give the Gatewood thing to Jimmy. He's not sanctioned as an attorney anymore.
No, but that's actually what I was going to ask you. And I actually meant to, you know, and I'm sure it varies, maybe state to state, I'm not sure. But could he not help, even if he's not an attorney and couldn't represent this other company, could he not help?
Yeah, sure. In the privacy where no one would know anything. Sure.
So, I mean, I don't know. I was just thinking about it like that. To bring
I would say
in
probably
other
legally, it's probably not legal for him to help, even in the dark of night where nobody can see them. It's probably not legal.
You don't think he could help even in like a paralegal sort of way?
No, I don't think so.
Okay. Well, I don't know
how anyone would ever catch it. I mean, he could proofread. He could give her advice. He could say, hey, don't write this paragraph this way. Nobody would ever know.
Well, I guess the only way that you could, you know, is that if she's billing 80 hours a week to Mesa Verde, and then she bills, you know, 60 hours a week to this Gatwood place, then, you know, there's no way. There's not that many hours in the week. So that would be a way that they would know that she's got somebody else.
Well, your numbers are a little low, but yeah, she couldn't bill 300 hours a week.
Right. I'm just saying, I don't know. I didn't know if that was something that's even allowed or not. But anyway.
You know, there are police. There are people that are in the public service that get like insane numbers of overtime. Like, well, that means you work 24 hours for 6 days in a row. How is that even freaking possible? You know, people do that. They pull that bullshit. But, yeah, you're right. She can't bill more than she can physically add or contribute work-wise and then expect to get away with it. Plus, I don't right. think she would do that either.
No, I don't either. But I don't know. I don't know what she's thinking because she told Kevin that she was going to take this, look it over, and then find a good attorney to handle it. And then right here, she decides she wants to keep him.
Yeah, but I think Kevin thinks she could do it. On her, she
Kevin
do
does, yeah. but Paige doesn't.
Right.
Paige wants her solely for them, which is what they had agreed upon.
I would see Kim trying to do Gatewood on her own, getting tired and making a real mistake that costs Kevin something. That would be like maybe the ultimate price that Jimmy costs her.
Yeah, that would be bad.
Her trying to help so much with the bills that it costs her everything.
Yeah.
So. Next scene, Howard goes to visit Chuck. He's surprised that he's out in the world. He's outside waiting, you know, thinking he might be inside, hurt or asleep or something. And Chuck comes waltzing up from the outside world. And Howard's very surprised. He wants to discuss malpractice insurance, an issue that they have with that. So that sounds pretty ominous for Chuck.
Well, yeah. Remember, that's what we ended with last episode, was what Jimmy told the malpractice insurance people about Chuck. We knew that was coming back.
So it must be super exorbitant fees that are going to be. You have an insane attorney, and he's worked for you for years, and now, you know, half your caseload for the last 16 years is going to be revisited by everybody. That is very bad.
Well, yeah. I mean, if news got out,
it's
can
out.
You imagine? Well, you know, I mean, like publicly, though. Well, I guess it is. Yeah, you're
right. It is. That's the problem. That's why Howard's angry. All right, Nacho goes to the roof now. And even to show even more intricacy of his plot with Hector, he pokes holes in the air conditioning pipeline so the air conditioner won't work. And Hector has to take off his coat.
Yeah, that was pretty smart. And that was pretty ninja-like of Nacho. Did you see how he jumped upon that wall? I mean, he was a good little ways away, and he jumped and, like, grabbed it with his hands. I was thinking, if he had missed that, that would have been an ugly fall.
So it works. Hector does take off his... They're sitting in there sweating. It looks miserable in that Michoacan.
Yeah, what about the guy cooking back there? And who's he cooking for? There's nobody in there. We've never seen anybody in there eating a thing except maybe Hector. And he's in there cooking.
Well, and they got I don't know. It might be super early in the morning. I don't know. It might be late at night. It might just be shitty restaurant.
Well, yeah, but he's cooking for somebody and there's nobody there.
Who wants to go to a meth dealer's restaurant? Or I guess it's cocaine dealer at this point.
Well, there's a sign up saying, excuse the annoyance, the air conditioner isn't working. So that was pretty funny.
So Nacho's in there with Crazy 8 with his beaten face, bruised up face, this time with all of his money. So that was a very good management tactic. He got him, he's getting all his money together.
Well, it's a tactic, yep.
And Nacho holds up a 50 to kind of fake out Hector that, hey, you need to take a closer look at this.
So how scared were you during this scene?
I wasn't scared. I was sitting at home.
Yeah, no, but did you not feel the tension of that?
Not yet. It was too early for Hector to catch Nacho. What is this, fake 50? You're trying to poison me.
No, but I mean, he could have even dropped it. I don't know. Something. I don't know.
I didn't really worry about this for some reason yet. I think Nacho's around till the end of this season. I think he's doomed. I think something bad is going to happen to him. And I also don't think this is what happens to Hector for some reason. I don't know. Hector does not get proper dose of nitroglycerin and goes stroked out and gets stuck in a wheelchair. I don't see that.
Yeah, I mean, it's... We would have been told the story, you know, so far ahead of time with all this, but I believe it, though.
All right, well, he holds up the 50, kind of faking it out. Hector's like, what are you doing? Let me see that. And he's Nacho portrays that he's not sure if it's real. Hector looks at it. No, it's real. Get back to work. And while Hector's looking at it, Nacho takes the pill bottle from his coat pocket. He has to look at both sides. It's the wrong pocket, right? The first side? He has to go to the other side.
Yes.
I mean, it was tense. You're right. It was kind of a sweated out scene. The next thug comes in with his deal, his delivery.
Yeah, Carlos.
I guess we see Nacho, too, sticks the pill in his belt so that he can keep it in the center where he can work on it when he sits back down and swap the pills.
Yeah, he definitely planned out, like, every move to this. And the fact that they were all in there sweating just made it worse.
Yeah, they even showed the pill stick to his fingers as sweat was on his hands.
Oh, I know. And his hands were shaking. Did you notice?
They actually said that in the Insider podcast that we've got to make a couple pills stick to his fingers because he's really sweating. So that was really planned out by the writers, too. And his hands are shaking. Yeah, you expected like 8 pills to drop to the floor or something.
Oh, I know.
Even one would have been bad.
Yeah, so, I would have.
I said it before, but just the hugeness of this act shows the power of Hector to have, he just commands fear over people. Almost like comically, like why is he so afraid of this guy? I guess he's afraid for his father and probably his own life, but he pulls
it off. I wonder why Nacho didn't just like drop the money, you know, behind him to get the pills like he did. And then go to the bathroom. You know, tell Hector I'll be back, you know, I'm going to the bathroom and do it in there or something. In place, he did it right in front of him, and not just right in front of him, but something else. That kitchen guy is right through that window, and I'm afraid that he saw what Nacho was doing. They didn't point it out either way, but I'm still a little bit concerned about that.
Yeah, that's a good point, maybe. I mean, you think Nacho might have had his body between the pocket and the guy in the kitchen with that? Because that window is, too. It's kind of high up. It's not like a big open space to look through.
No, but you can absolutely see what's going on through one of those kitchen windows. I've, you know, had enough family restaurant business stuff that I've been back there. And you can see. He could have definitely seen, had he been looking, what was going on with... with Nacho out there reaching into the pocket. And when he was putting it back, maybe not. That was really quick. But as he was taking it out, he literally reached around the back because, just like you said, it wasn't in the one on that side. That side he might have been covering, but when he reached around, he definitely, I don't think, was covering what he was doing. And the guy in the kitchen, you could hear the sizzling on the grill where that guy was standing, and they made a point to show him wiping his brow because, I mean, can you imagine? It's hot back there anyway, much less without an air conditioner. So, but they made a point of showing him, and then the whole time you could hear the sizzling. So he's still there. He's cooking. I don't know. It just makes me nervous because I'm afraid that he did see something, and we don't even know who this guy is as far as I know.
So he makes the drop. It works on his first try. And the reason I guess I wasn't really too afraid for him this time, Michelle, is remember, he has to do the reverse of all this. If he follows Mike's advice, get the pills back after Hector takes the fake pills.
Oh, that's another good point. Well, yeah, but I mean, if Hector takes the fake pills, he does have to change it, but he's not going to have Hector there watching him.
No, I mean, everybody. But what if the cartel descends on the place? All right, what happened? Hector's a big important boss. What the hell happened?
He's taking nitroglycerin because he gets so upset. I mean, You know, that's not like a 35-year-old athlete that something would happen to.
I know, but they did. But when Mike gave him the advice to take the pills away and swap them back after you do it, it didn't seem like good idea. I'll do that. Like, no problem. It's like that's like maybe even harder than the first swap.
That's a good point, though. Yeah, bringing that up. Right.
All right. Back to Jimmy doing the community service. The asshat guy tells him to work harder. God, this guy.
What'd you call him?
Asshat.
Asshat?
Yeah. He's a dick.
He's really bad.
He works hard. He tells him to work even harder than he's already working.
Oh, I know. Jimmy's like picking up these really dirty diapers and trying to put them in this bag. And his back hurts. And all he did was like stretch his back. He literally took, 10 seconds to stretch his back. And this guy's on him about that. Get back to work. Get busy. It's like, dang. Wow.
So, I mean, I think they overplayed their hand a little bit, the writers, with this guy, because then he won't let the kid, the other kid working, go see his sick daughter. I mean, that's how much lower could you stoop to make the guy look like a real weasel? But no, you can't go. You can go, but you won't get any credit for today. So
I wonder how true that is, though.
I bet it's true that they have a lot of discretion, because nobody's going to keep track of that. The guy could just say, get out of here. I don't care. Come back tomorrow.
Hope
your daughter does okay. You know, nobody's going to catch him at anything.
Well, yeah, that. Or, you know, he could, you know, like, not let him go. And then this kid, what's his name? I wrote down his name. Freddie. Freddie could tell on him, so to speak. You know, go to his, whoever's above this guy. And would they believe Freddie over this guy? You know, they wouldn't. I don't know. It just seems that he's put in this position of power that he is obviously not able to handle with any kind of good discretion.
No, obviously not. He's an older guy. That's how he got to be the person he is. He's abused every inch of little power play that he can to be a dick. So, I mean, even if he never is going to get caught, he still wants to exert that power over everybody he can.
So what did you think about what Jimmy did with him?
I liked it.
Did you?
Yeah, I mean, it's a lot. Okay, I liked what Jimmy does. And Jimmy's lying to him. He's insubordinate with him. I mean, he really shouldn't have done what he did. But I liked it. It's like getting people in trouble for shit that they shouldn't be doing. It's karma. I just like it. Even if it's by hook or by crook, I like what Jimmy did.
Okay.
Well, what did you think of it?
Well, yeah, here specifically, I did like what Jimmy did, because Jimmy did I mean, first of all, he benefited himself. He did not hurt the guy, the Freddy guy. I mean, you know, he took $700 because he estimated that the guy had over 2,000, that he's a drug dealer. What did he say? I forget what he said. It rhymes with, you know, Brug Mealer or something like that.
Yeah.
You know, so he knew that the guy had a lot of money. So he wasn't like taking advantage of this guy to go see his kid so much. And, or, you know, we assume that. And with the guy who's over him, you know, he didn't, I mean, he threatened him, but he didn't threaten him physically or anything like that. He just scared him with the, you know, long arm of the law, so to speak, or at least the long arm of the lawyer, and court and stuff like that, and being tied up. And I thought it was a real interesting situation.
So were you asking me what I thought about what Jimmy did to Freddie or what Jimmy did to the boss man?
The boss man. It was the boss man.
I think
I don't think he did anything to Freddie.
I mean, that's an audience cheering scene. I think everybody loved what he did to the boss man.
And what about Freddie when he comes up?
Freddie's
He's very happy. He says it's the best $700 he's ever spent.
He'll get $700 in another half day of dealing drugs.
And he called him, like, you know, what, mind ninja trick or something.
Yeah.
And he got to go see his daughter.
Right. So, his sick daughter, yeah. I mean,
she had pneumonia. She's in the hospital. It's bad.
I don't know. So they had some interesting, the words that Jimmy shared with Boss Man were pretty funny. The land of the free and home of the lawsuit. I think you brought that up in a preview before.
Yeah.
Jimmy hits him with a bunch of charges that may or may not have stuck in court. And he leverages all the math on the guy, just swamps the guy with, you know, Saul Goodman legalese. You can go out and hire a lawyer for $90 an hour, and we'll be there in court for 5 years. And also, your pinhole of a reputation you have down at the bowling alley on Glow Ball Sunday will be ruined forever.
Right. And I think that's like the bigger picture, because, you know, the boss guy's saying, you'll never win. And Jimmy goes, but I'm going to be in court for the next 5 years. And so is the judge. And this is going to bring you into the court. And it's going to cost you $90 an hour for you to be there just to defend yourself.
Yeah, it's the perfect argument. You're right. I never will win, but it'll take you 5 years to win at $90 an hour.
Right.
How do you argue with that? Guy's like, oh, shit.
Yeah, he's like, this is a third mortgage kind of thing.
So Jimmy takes his $700, lays on his back and smiles, and, you know, that's Saul Goodman.
Yes, it is. Sure is.
All right, Michelle, Mike goes to your favorite place, the secret hidey hole in the floor.
He does. I love that.
Takes a lot of money out and waits in the desert, or goes in the desert to think. I guess he's not really waiting. Then he goes to Gus for advice about $200,000 in cash he wants to get to his family.
When something happens to him, once he's gone, because he says his family will never see it if something happens to him.
So I guess this is all prompted by finding the body, alerting the police. He's worried now something may happen to him because of his putting his neck out a little bit.
Well, yeah, I think it all goes back to Anita and her husband leaving and nobody ever knowing, you know, what happened to him and who knows what he might, you know, could have had or whatever. And then the guy, the Good Samaritan, and him, you know, being taken away and nobody's going to know what happened to him. And now Mike's thinking about his end and how, you know, he's got all this money. He says he can't spend it. I mean, you know, you can't do what Mike does and work as a ticket taker at a parking garage and have $200,000 cash that you're throwing around. So it's a really, it's a good point that he's saying, but now he knows that Gus is laundering money and Gus won't do it because, the Salamancas might get wind of it. Correct? Is that what he's saying?
Well, I think Gus maybe that's part of it, but I think Gus sees a bigger value in some other sort of payment that Mike would owe him besides 20%.
Yeah, he said something more difficult or whatever. And so Mike says, you know, 20%, will that overcome the difficulty? And then he says, I wouldn't take money from your family. He wants Mike to work for him.
Right.
Right? Okay.
Yeah, that's okay. worth that's way more than $40,000. But I kind of thought Mike was worried that if he ever got disappeared, like the Samaritan and this other guy, you know, that could have very well happened to him. Then that money just stays lost in the hidey hole. No one ever finds it. Never gets to Kaylee.
Well, sure.
So now he's putting that mechanism into play that at least there's a way now I can clean this money and get it somehow to Kaylee's college fund or whatever.
But how sad is that, knowing what we know?
Well, it's sad, but it makes the story great.
I guess that really hurt my feelings kind of to see Mike go, you know, I don't think he wants to have anything to do with Gus as far as I think he respects him as a, you know, businessman. I don't know. That's not really what I'm thinking, but like that. But I don't think he wants to work with him. I don't think he wants to be a part of any of this. No, of course.
Mike doesn't want to have anything to do with anybody. He doesn't even want the church people to help him with a wheelbarrow full of cement. He's a lone wolf. He just wants to be left the hell alone, give something to his family when he's gone. He doesn't want a job with Gus at all.
But he's willing to sacrifice all of that and do the job with Gus just so Kaylee can have...
Yeah. He feels something. He has not much of other choice, though. There's not many options that he has.
And then the way we know this ends is just awful. I didn't like that. That was sad to me.
You were sad when they shook hands?
I was sad because he's really giving up basically his peace of mind and his, you know, closest thing I guess we would ever see, Mike, to retirement, to do what he ends up doing with Gus to... make sure that his family gets that money, and we know that it doesn't end that way.
You know, so, it was really a sad scene when Gomez popped his head into that little bank security box room with a big goofy smile on his face, and the cake pop lady knew that she had let them in there. I was like, oh shit, they're gonna catch. There's Mike's money down the drain.
Yep.
I didn't like that scene with Gomez. But Gus and Mike shake hands, and that's how this episode ends, Michelle. So 308, Slip is over. We saw what Slip meant.
Yep.
What do you think?
Slip fall, and Jimmy.
What do you think Fall's going to be 309? Got any previews?
Well, yeah, I do have previews. Let me tell you the previews, and then I'll give you just like what I'm thinking about Fall, because Slip was not what I thought it was going to be. Slip was Slip and Jimmy we saw again, which was interesting. It was really good, and I'm glad that they didn't give us a lot of clues to that because I really enjoyed seeing that. Okay, on Fall, someone's telling Chuck that if he is threatening litigation, then the meeting's over, and this is the insurance people, and Chuck says, well, it's over. And then Mike is sitting in a hallway as somebody's going by on a Segway, and he's saying, you run the money through this joint and then it's clean. Is that it? And I think he's probably talking to Gus or something, but you can't tell. And then Jimmy tells Howard that he's screwing clients and asks if Jimmy and Howard asks if Jimmy is now worried about the clients. So I don't know what's going on with the clients.
So Jimmy means that Howard is screwing clients?
Yes.
And Howard's like, well, so now you're worried about clients?
Right.
Okay.
And Chuck says, imagine me as your enemy. And Hector breaks something in anger. They're in like this darkened place, and he breaks something in anger as he's looking at Gus. Now, that was all on the upcoming. And then the longer version on AMC.com shows the insurance company giving Chuck and Howard a hard time about insuring Chuck, and Chuck threatening to sue him. It's like a minute and a half of a scene with... It seems like what they want to do is they want another attorney to work with Chuck to essentially cover him and make sure he's doing right, but they can't bill the client for that. So it's essentially like Chuck's going to be working for free when he works or something. That's the only way the insurance company will stay with them and on Chuck. That's what it looked like. But I think the fall is going to be, I just have this feeling that the fall is going to be the fall of Chuck.
God, I hope not. Chuck is such a, I don't know, I've said it, I'm doing laps and laps around it, but I hope the fall is more profound. This is the end of the season. There's two left. I hope the fall is maybe Jimmy and Kim, something more profound. I don't care about Howard and Chuck. I don't care that much about them. I really don't care that much about Nacho. He's one of my favorite characters in this, but I think he's sort of doomed by the end of 3:10. Or
what makes you think that? Why do you think that?
Just because he's so likable, and there has to be a price to pay in this, and it can't just be Chuck, because we fucking hate Chuck, man. Everybody's gonna be happy when he falls. I think it's got a dramatic, kind of sad ending. It's got to be to pull us back in if they get another season or do another season.
Well, yeah, but like with Nacho, Nacho could go on for a while. Nacho is real nerve-wracking to me because we kind of we like Nacho, right, in a way, because we know that Mike likes Nacho. Mike respects him. They respect one another. He seems, this sounds ridiculous, but ethical in whatever way he is ethical.
No, it's not ridiculous. He is. And I think we've won a few battles. All the good guys have kind of won a few things. Like it looks like Nacho's dad is going to be protected. It looks like Mike got his money situation figured out. It looks like Jimmy got his money figured out. It's kind of going okay now with these guys. So I think there's a fall. I think some of the and I don't like Howard now much at all, and I definitely don't like Chuck. So if they fall, that's more good things happening. So I think the fall is for somebody that we like, one of the good guys.
Okay, but then what's Lantern going to be?
I don't know.
Lantern could be Chuck. Has to be Chuck. It has to be. And do you want the finale to be about Chuck? It's got to be, though.
Only
right?
If he's really. I wouldn't mind if something happens to Chuck as long as it's connected to something I care about.
Okay.
And I don't care if they let Chuck, nothing happen to him. He just stuck alone, you know, or he comes back. I don't care. I just don't care about him.
Okay. I'm just afraid that they're going to make us like him and like him reach out to Jimmy or whatever. And then they're going to like axe him.
That's too puppety. That's pulling too many emotional strings. They would never do that. They're too good of writers.
Yeah, I don't know. It's very Gilligan-esque.
Nah, I think he's way better than that. Jimmy's already said, I disown you, you're not my brother anymore. Now he's going to be his loving brother again? I don't see.
Well, not his loving brother again. But, I mean, you know, he's had some pretty profound insights, even in this episode. I don't know. Even said, Mike, you're Chuck's number one, you know, nemesis. You're his number one anti-fan, and you even said, and I started to like Chuck a little bit, and then I thought, no, I don't like Chuck.
Yeah, but that's not a story mechanism. I think that's a, you know, Chuck can't be totally bad. He's got a little bit of good, but I don't care about him. That's the worst thing, good or bad of anything, is like indifference, and that's how I feel about Chuck, like bored. And that's what I feel when I see Chuck. It's like, oh, God. You know, I don't care if he gets over his electromagnetism fear, you know. I don't care if he gets back together with Rebecca. It's silly.
I don't know. I mean, I don't feel as much apathy toward him as you do, I don't think. But I agree that the Chuck story is old. I'll agree with that.
Lantern is also very obviously connected to Chuck, so that tells me like these guys wouldn't set that up. These are the guys that make the episode titles have sentences that mean things, that, you know, they're crafty. And the lantern finally tipped over. Who would have thought that by the name of that title? It's too obvious, you know.
So what's it going to be?
We we conspiracy theory everything to death. I know that. So maybe it is just something simple like that. But for that to be the ending point of drama in this season would be really lame, I think.
Oh, I would not be... I don't know. I don't know if I agree with you on that, but I would not be surprised if Chuck's death is not the end of this episode. Maybe the beginning of the end of this episode, and that's what we see, the complete changeover to Saul. But I don't know. That, yeah. And, okay, so if episode 9 ends up being... the fall, if that ends up being the fall with Kimmy, something to do, or Kim, I don't know why I keep calling her Kimmy, Kim, then that's going to put Jimmy, like, on the edge. He's going to be on the gangplank over the edge, right? And then if something happened to Chuck and he dies in the fight, in a fire, then that could just be the absolute... you know, bridge that's burned between Jimmy and Saul.
That's
you
reminded me of another thing that's kind of on the winning track is now Kim. Kim's got a really good job. She's got that boss loves her so much. He's given her referrals. And, you know, that guy, if the oil company guy meets her, he's going to love her. So something has to happen to one of these good characters that we like.
And the penultimate episode frequently is when they do their big stuff. So I guess we'll see.
All right, Michelle. Well, that's it. 309 Fall. How do people reach you?
On Twitter, I'm at Michelle from TN.
And I'm at Scathing Tweets. We do a lot of podcasts on West Coast Project, including The Americans and Fargo and The Affair. The Affair. The Slap.
Yep.
Better Call Saul.
You keep bringing Lily, up Slap.
I bring up all the dead ones, sure.
That would be funny if there was like a second Slap. That's not
Slap
funny,
Revival. But... Orange is the New Black.
Oh, my goodness. That's back
Making
on.
Making a Murderer. Right? You know, some of these we bailed on before we were even finished with them. But that's okay. We're just doing this for fun.
We need to do The Handmaid's Tale.
Yeah, that's good. What episode are you on?
Well, I've seen through 7.
All right, Michelle, I might have a mysterious way of getting you number 8 if you want it.
Yeah, I'd love to see number 8. That's what I'm waiting for.
All right. Well, until 309 Fall, we'll see you next week on West Coast Project, same time, same channel, Michelle.
Okay, Mike. We'll see you then.
Bye.
Bye-bye.